Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. It gives me great pleasure to be inviting Richard Allen Miller here today, the author of ESP Induction Through Forms of Self-Hypnosis. Richard Allen Miller is an author, a physicist, a biophysicist, and an herbalist. This book is one of a three-book series on the evolution of consciousness. Mr. Miller has had 11 years in Navy intelligence and was a lead physicist at the Pentagon for six of those years. He has done massive amounts of work in the area of anesthesia at the University of Washington. He's managed many intelligence projects that have to do with anesthesia and intuition. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Richard Allen Miller to It's Rainmaking Time. Good day, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Well, I've had enjoyable talking with you.
Same here with you. ESP induction, what does that mean?
Well, basically, extrasensory perception, I think we're going to find it's not exactly what we think it is. It's not like seeing into the future as much as we're more or less creating our own future. One word that could be used would be intuitions. And how does one tap further into those already known informations? Basically, when we started with SEAL Corporation, which was eventually later called SEAL Corp or then Navy SEALs, the primary role was for me to develop a tool by which to separate the top 2% of Navy, let's say, graduates at Annapolis. Which 2% do we train further? And rather than how many bridges you could blow up, how much martial arts you know, the primary focus was on intuition and the ability to guess. When they came to a fork in the road, they wanted a 10-second protocol to determine going right or left. And they wanted a 3-sigma error coefficient on that.
What does that mean?
Well, a sigma is your standard deviation, and a 3-sigma means that you are 99.9975% correct in your decision-making. And we discovered in a laboratory that there was an altered state of consciousness, just very close to our conscious awake state, but just slightly over to the left there, that your ability in guessing would increase more than 400 times where you are in a conscious state. And what they wanted was something that was very quick and very simple to teach. And then we looked for those that were right out of the gate already tapped into that and then tried to improve their ability in guessing. And those were the people that Navy decided then to go further and train them further. But the first criteria was intuitions, their ability in making a proper guess.
Is that what intuition is?
Well, it's difficult to know what it is, you know.
Isn't it a sensing?
Well, there's different ways you can define that. For example, you have a gut feeling. Sometimes we've always referred to the gut, like my gut says I should do this. That's because, in fact, we have now discovered that there are actual brain cells in your gut that function very similar to those in your brain. And there is, you have a different kind of feel. Now, the big key is, how do you tap into that with consciousness so that you can actually use those intuitions as a tool? That was the challenge. We wanted to know how to take that information and somehow filter it so that we had a conscious awareness of it and were then able to act on it, that kind of thing.
Does breathing come into any of this in terms of tapping into the gut brain, something called the gut brain?
Well, yes and no. Yes, breathing is the first and last thing anybody does when they come into force space. The first thing you do when you come out of the womb is they whack you and you take your first gasp of air. And usually that's the last thing that you do when you exit this area. And so breathing has always been considered so important that it was actually in our universe part of our entire training process where 10% of our life, whether you were jogging or riding a bicycle or doing Tai Chi, it was part of training the body and the mind, working to, you know, working as a unit. And so breathing is extremely important in that regard.
What is induction? The title of your book is ESP Induction.
You induce it. You bring it forth. That's what induction means, to bring forth. We found that we already know what we should be doing, which way to go. How do we bring it into consciousness so that there's no question, where there's no doubt? That part would be called induction, bringing it forth into a conscious level of awareness so that you are aware that this is the way I want to go, not that way. Later, I think we're going to find that it isn't that you're taking a peek into the future, you know, with clairvoyance or whatever, that in fact what you're doing is taking a look at the possibilities and making a decision on which way you can pull it off. And that will be ultimately toward the last book in the series called The Non-Local Mind in a Holographic Universe. If you choose to see the universe as a holographic system rather than a quantized universe, what happens next is that information takes on a different dimension of resolution. And that's what we're really actually doing when we talk about things like it's a physical thing or it's an emotional thing or it's an intellectual thing. They're actually all the same. They're just more higher vibration. Is that the right word? The higher form of the same phenomena. In other words, information is everywhere. And how do you tap into that? And how you tap into it with the resolution of it is to whether it has emotional, intellectual, or physical content to it.
Can you describe to us what is a hologram in your translation as a physicist?
Yeah, hologram.
Yeah. Why is it so prevalent today and important?
I have a story on how I discovered it. In 1969, I was already out of graduate school. It was 1967. Excuse me. I was still in graduate school. I was at the University of Delaware, and they invited me over to the Experimental Research Station, DuPont, in Wilmington. And I was walking by, going to my labs there, and I was walking down a hall, and I looked in, and I saw a three-dimensional color TV, and this is 1967 now, that was actually operational. A big question in my mind is, why don't we have it in our universe today? But what they had done, there had been a mathematician named Geber that had discovered that you could, what holographic meant was a compression of information. In other words, you could compress N dimensions of information into N minus one dimensions. Let's explore that. That would mean like a DNA. The DNA is a three-dimensional hologram of force space. That's because DNA contains who you were, who you are, and who you will be.
What do you mean by force space? I need to pull you back a little bit.
Time. Adding time to the length, girth, and width of reality.
Okay.
And then if you stopped and looked at the brain, which is kind of like a big crystal on the top of an antenna, your body, you could say that the brain is a four-dimensional hologram of five space. That means it's constantly changing with amorphous semiconductors and liquid crystal phases in the brain. It's at any given moment, it's in constant change, which means it's a four-dimensional hologram of five space. And what that implies is that you can change the movie. That means what you're experiencing, most of us on the earth right now, is what I would call horror on Elm Street. It's a terrible reality, but it's because of where we're observing reality from which site in the brain. And meditation and other forms of altered states of consciousness, you know, with biofeedback training, drugs, other ways you alter the brain, changes those places where we're observing the brain, in which case we see something different, and basically it means we're actually seeing a different kind of reality. And if you could control where you took resonance in the brain, you could most likely also change your perception of reality and, in fact, the actual reality being experienced.
When you talk about if you could control the resonance in the brain, what do you mean by that? And explain what resonance is to our listeners.
Resonance is the harmonic relationship of one thing to another. That means that, like a standing wave or a sound wave going from, like a wave in the ocean going from here to there, the resonance is when it picks up an amplitude increase because it's reinforcing itself back and forth. And resonance means that there is an equal number of waves that fit in this unit or space. Not that it's half and that the wave is choppy, but that in fact it just perfectly fits. That's what resonance means. Resonance is a type of unit measurement of this to that.
Okay.
So, you know, you're trying to seek resonance with something. You're in harmony with it because it exactly fits.
I have a hunch that the key to opening up new fundings around the world for research and development, for discoveries, for solutions, has critically to do with establishing a resonant system of funding.
Well, that means that it's reinforcing itself. It is self promoting, if you will. It is
self-generating.
Continuing. It is not being diminished by attenuation or absorption, but that it is perfectly fitting to bouncing this wall, bouncing that wall, to the point where there's no energy loss. When you have that, that would be called resonance. You fit or in harmony with the situation.
Explain what attenuation is. I think that's very important.
Well, attenuation is the loss of something. It's being attenuated or absorbed. It's a type of friction. It's a type of loss. Attenuation, when you have a signal that's being attenuated through water, it's because the water is absorbing the energy and the signal going through it is becoming less. It's attenuated brought or absorbed, if you will. And so the amplitude of the wave begins to diminish like a friction, things slow down, etc.
And one point of clarification here for everybody listening. Is resonance the same as frequency?
No, frequency is your actual, how many waves are there in 1 inch, let's say. That's your frequency. If you had 20 waves, the frequency would be higher than if you had 12 waves. So obviously light is different than sound because of the difference in frequency. It's all electromagnetic radiation, whether you talk about it as sound, light, gamma rays, or you go in the other direction to microwave. You start with infrared, which is heat. You move into sound and then light and then higher frequencies like microwave. Microwaves have such high frequency of waves between this inch and that inch that they are verging on the level of quantum mechanics, and there is very little that can stop or shield or absorb microwaves because they are so fine and so tiny and so many of them in the waves that there's very little defense against something like microwave.
Well, there's a lot of microwave stations all over America.
Oh, yeah. Imagine that.
What do we do?
That's because it doesn't take much energy to move from this point to that point. And that's because there is very little to attenuate that signal. There's very little that can absorb it. That's what they call microwaves. Those are probably the highest level of information that we've ever been able to measure is in the microwave band. In other words, you know, we're talking about megahertz and gigahertz. That means, you know, 100,000 signals in one little inch, that kind of thing.
Because there's so much microwave radiation, I was just wondering what your take is on how we may protect ourselves from this level.
Yeah, that's a real common and important question to ask. The one we focus on now is called dosimetry. Dosimetry is the measure of toxicity of a given radiation band. In microwave, have certain bandwidths, 0.3 to 3 gigahertz, for example, that have explicit effects on the body, whereas at 4 gigahertz, it passes through the body without much damage. 5 megahertz, in other words, there are dosimetry bands of toxicity. They used to call that in the early years when we were doing radiation studies and you were in high energy physics or something, you had to wear a dosimetry badge or a radiation badge that would measure how much you were exposed to determine whether or not you needed to cut back, you couldn't go back into that lab for a while, or you were toxic and got exposed to some lethal radiation. When I was a scientist in working in these kinds of fields, we were always concerned about x-rays because, you know, your body can take only so many of them before it starts to break down. And it became important that in that field of technology, the amplitude, the amount of radiation was brought down to, you know, a place where it wasn't damaging the body.
What do you think of these new machines that are being put in airports to x-ray our bodies?
I would say that there's no problem anymore than your microwave for doing pizza parlor. That bandwidth and the amount of exposure is so nominal as to be insignificant.
Really?
The sun sets off a sunspot. Now you may have some serious problems. And so that's why they say in certain years it's better not to go out into the sunlight because there are sunspots right now happening and they're lethal. Of course, some of those can go right through your home, your clothing, your sun shields or screens that you might use, like a hot knife through butter. There are very little some can do with microwaves from the sun. When the sun blows off steam like that in the corona, you can have some serious problems. We're ranging all over the place here, but that's fine.
I just wanted to ask you about x-rays. We were talking about radiation, and I wanted to ask you about that. Now, what does entrainment have to do with intuition and quantum physics?
Well, that gets back to your concept of resonance. When you entrain the mind or the brain using brain drivers or other kinds of things, what you're doing is attempting to try to cause the brain to resonate in certain frequencies. The most common one that people would talk about would be things like alpha, where you're trying to go into a light alpha state, which is slightly different than where you are right now in a beta state. In an alpha state, for example, the brain has a certain kind of frequency band that it will resonate in the back part of the occipital region of the cerebral cortex, your visual range. It would be alpha states are associated with not seeing objects, but just seeing patterns and a light, where you're not recognizing them as a chair or something like that. It's a place that is powerful if you can entrain the brain and train it to be resonating in certain frequencies. You can do tool. You can use that as a tool, and be able to do things. We know, for example, that in a theta state, maximum healing occurs. When you're really sick, the best thing to do is you go down into a deep sleep. That's where the body is able to heal itself more quickly. That place is known as theta. That's why you go down there. You do it instinctively. Imagine being able to do that as a tool. I did a dive into the Soviet Union once as part of a mission I was doing, and I was scared. You know, I dove at 50,000 feet, so in an EVA suit, going down like a missile, so I was above and beyond radar, and I was scared, but the braking system worked. What happened was, when I left, they missed my pickup, and I was in the Bering Sea for almost 6 days.
Oh, my God.
I know. But what happened was I had studied biofeedback, and I had trained my body to go down into a, if you will, a Mandrake the Magician, where I lowered my heart rate, and I knew I was going to die, so I decided, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die the way I want to die, and that's to do everything I can for maximum effort in towards survival. And what I did is I went down into deep brain states and lowered my heart, and when they found me, I was like Mandrake the Magician. They couldn't tell whether I was alive or dead, but what I had done is entrained my body to go way down into a place called stasis, where I could sit and survive. I was very lucky, but you know, because 6 days without food or water and deep exposure like the Bering Sea, but that's what made us capable of becoming supermen, was that we were capable of controlling certain autonomic functions in the body. And that was where we started training with biofeedback and brain entrainment techniques.
Why did you become a SEAL?
Well, I wasn't a SEAL. What I was their physicist. I was, they didn't have anybody like me in Navy. In fact, the story there is kind of interesting. They actually had a bullseye on me when I was a junior in high school, and I was like a draft pick for NASA or something. I later, they have gifted students or gifted children that they watch and follow and try to recruit. I was not in Navy. What I ended up being was what they call a GS-18 or Government Issue 18. I was as high as you get, where I had certain vaults, that I had. I had a vault permit, so I didn't require a need to know to walk into that vault. I could walk in at any point and do anything I wanted in there, whereas a two-star general had to have a reason to go into that vault. I was a manager of it, and that was like a reader, you know, in 3 days of the Condor. That's what I did, was I was a reader trying to connect dots that other people couldn't. And the first thing that happened was it's Navy. Navy has always been the leader in the militaries for technology, and that was run mostly by DuPont. So I guess Navy intelligence is kind of like the Jesuits with the Church of DuPont, if you want to get the metaphor.
Fascinating.
There.
Fascinating.
Well, that's pretty much where it was this last century. Navy did all the deep studies. It wasn't Army. You know, men who stare at goats. You know, that was 20 years later. I couldn't imagine running into a wall as a concept, as a physicist trying to become a Superman. It wasn't trying to talk myself into something I can't do. I had to have a temporal connection on how that might work at science. And that is what it's really all about. It's not about science. It's what is in your mind's eye that becomes reality. And how you take something from psyche into matter is a process that this first book, the ESP book, discusses as a series of protocols. The second book, coming out in July, I believe I'm in final draft on it. I'm writing it right now. I'll be doing some work on it today, is called Power Tools for the 21st Century, which talks about the 8 basic means or protocols I developed for Navy SEALs to make them supermen, of which brain drivers and biofeedback and mythic living, the way you choose to assimilate what's going on in your environment, determines your belief systems, determine what you can and can't do. How did that expression go? I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. It all starts with your belief systems and your mind's eye.
In your book, you say that you have a system of guided images and protocols, and that anyone's ability can be improved to more than 400% in less than 2 weeks.
Not 400%. That's 4 times. 400 times. And that is beyond statistical inference. In other words, it's not about time or space. That gets covered in the first chapter of the book when we talked about the Apollo 14 mission studies with Edgar Mitchell and the ESP studies I did with him during that ESP has, it's inside the mind. It's not outside like PK phenomena. Dr. Rind, when he did his classic studies in the 30s, broke extrasensory perception into two categories. It's either inside the body or it's outside the body. And inside the body, it was all labeled as ESP, and outside the body, it was called PK phenomena, like levitation, apportation, teleportation, that kind of thing, where you're taking objects, not yourself, and doing physical phenomena with it. The only place where ESP had one of those is called radiesthesia. ESP is broken into five categories. There's clairvoyance, telepathy, astral projection, radiesthesia, and precognition. Now, precognition is, you know, seeing into the future. We also had retrognition, which goes into that same thing where you see an event that happened in the past, but it's in your mind's eye. Whereas apportation is where you take and pull a gem out of your mouth, and it's a physical object that all of a sudden is now in the physical plane. And that was where it was outside the body. And so ESP dealt with everything that was inside the body, mind's eye. Astral projection was quite different than remote viewing. Remote viewing came later. There was a, that's an interesting concept. Basically in the 70s, there was open fields for research. We didn't know where they were going. It didn't matter. Research was important for research itself. However, in the 80s, there was a change in the sciences where if it did not have application, it was of no interest to pursue it, and there were no budgets to fund it. And that's when astral projection, like Shirley MacLaine being out on a limb, changed, and it became remote viewing, where they could use it as a way to see what your enemy was doing. Later, it was discovered that remote viewing was actually, in fact, a part of PK phenomena and was quite dangerous because this was with Russell Targ and some of those people later at SRI. Stanford Research Institute started doing some of the basic studies like we did up at the UW, and I worked with a man called Andrea Puharich who did some of these studies, which was then later changed with people like Russell Targ and Bentoff and some others. They were trying to then take a peek at what the Russians were doing. The problem was that when doing so, it caused changes in the observer. And that became a kind of danger because you weren't sure what you were, you know, getting into and what possible changes it might be to the body. I would caution people on remote viewing, simply be aware that when you're taking a peek working with those protocols, that, you know, you might affect yourself in such a way that would be, you know, damaging.
What does that mean when you say damaging? Like, I interviewed Paul Smith, who wrote Reading the Enemy's Mind.
Well, the enemy's mind might become partly your own mind. How do you feel like that? Like that in Farscape, when Triton takes on Morpheus's mind inside his own mind. And where that
is, that a function of entrainment?
That could come under that form of definition, yes. And so the studies on that are not going in that direction. If I were still in the field, you bet I'd be on that like stink on shit. I would try to figure out what the limits and variables were in that regard. And I haven't seen a lot of interest in that. It's mostly trying to do it as a weapon. You'll see these sci-fi stories where they'll take these gifted kids, feed them drugs to try to get them to see what the enemy's doing. And they'll do it in a way that's a confinement and damaging to the kids. And in all cases, you'll notice the sci-fi stories will show that it's damaging the people that are doing it. In fact, that's exactly what I discovered before I left the media. I left in the 80s because I didn't really like what I was doing and the kinds of weapons that I was developing. Man, you know, we did all the up in Seattle. We did all the chip implants. Delgado was there before he moved to Yale. We did all the drug studies with Dr. Moore. We were doing ketamine telepathing and BC studies, and then, of course, my work in microwave for mind control. And there's a paper on my website called Synthetic Telepathy and the Early Mind Wars. That's an interesting paper because that was what we could do in the 70s. Imagine where that's gone now.
Then how do we know that we are picking up when we're being still and, let's say, doing some meditation and getting quiet? How do we know that what's coming in is something from the universe that's positive versus some entrainment from microwave stations?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's black or white. I'm not sure. It's more like in living color. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. In fact, I'm of two minds. How did Two-Face put it in the Batman movie? I'm of two minds on that. And, you know, that's an interesting concept. The idea of voice of reason and voice of coyote. You know, you've got the voice of reason on the one shoulder saying, stay inside the box. And then you've got your voice of coyote. Oh, it's okay. Take a peek outside. Step outside the box for a moment. Now, it turns out, this is the really good, interesting part, that the voice of coyote and the voice of reason are actually the same voice. We have polarized them because the voice of reason keeps us in the box and there is no change and you feel safe. It's when you step outside the box that you begin to have doubt, and with doubt comes fear and uncertainty, and that is very uncomfortable. However, that is also the place where you make changes in your personality or your lifestyle. And so the two are absolutely required, one for the other, to have a balance in personal growth. And what you need to do, what I need to do, we all need to do, is learn how to hear, listen, and evaluate those inner voices of ours. This is how one gets closer to the Lord. It's called self-realization, because the ego or conscious awareness of us is primarily only there for survival. And what's very important, it's very, very important, you must always realize that sometimes it's safe to do that. And so you have to form this dialogue, and it takes many, many years to learn how to listen to your inner voice. I have personally decided that the inner voice is the 9/10 of my cerebral cortex that I'm not using at any given moment, trying to have dialogue with that part that is aware, and that the two are trying to form union, because once they do that, I will be able to maximize my full potential.
I've been told and read that the subconscious knows everything, is a knower.
Well, that's your guardian angel. That's what they call the guardian angel. By the way, I apologize for not being able to turn off. Someone is being very persistent on my call waiting, and I don't know how to turn that off at this moment, so we're just going to have to hear those little beeps as they come through. This is normally an office, and I'm normally on the phone at this time of morning, but now I'm with you. That presumes another concept which ties it all together in suggesting that the brain is a four-dimensional hologram of five space. That means that all possible realities, everything, is possible, predicated on which part of the brain you're observing. And that means that everything's possible. It's just where you choose to set up shop. And some of that, unfortunately, is done prenatally. I mean, you know, mom has a fight with dad, and you come out with an attitude or a chip on your shoulder. Sets up certain behavior patterns, sets up certain belief systems. Look at the difference in the way a dog is whelped and the devotion and love and closeness to spirit that that animal has that we don't. I think there was an author, Steve Gaskins, that wrote several books. One was called Monday Night Class, and then the second one was called Spiritual Midwifery, where he suggested the way you're birthed sets up your belief systems and the position and where you work from the brain as to the kind of reality that you had. And he later formed a thing called The Farm in Tennessee. His whole point was that if we birthed our children differently, our children would behave differently. And that's true. We already know that birth and so on. But the problem is our beliefs have become gospel. And really, what the second book is about is how to use belief systems like you would a pair of clothing. When it's not appropriate, you take your clothing off and you change it, your belief system. However, if you're a Christian, for example, would you see the two aliens that walked in the door? If your belief systems do not allow that kind of a reality, is it possible for that reality to happen? And so, doesn't mean you get rid of Christianity when you drop your belief systems. I have a pair of bell bottoms I'm never going to fit into again, but they represent a part of my life where I still keep them all nicely folded and neat in a special drawer that I like to bring out and look at because they're very close and very warm to me and making me feel more like myself. Belief systems are the same, but sometimes those belief systems are not appropriate for a given situation. And that's why Navy SEAL was trained to be able to change their belief systems by changing what part of the brain they chose to go to observe reality. If it wasn't working, you change your belief.
Talk about, if you would, the quantum realm. You had spoken earlier about the holographic realm.
Right.
And then
the universe has originally, one of the first ways we chose to look at the universe was that it was quantized, that elementary particles had basic building blocks in the universe, and that they were this way, not that way, and that there were mutual exclusions, or there were spaces between this and that that didn't happen, or were not part of reality. That is because the brain itself has been hardwired to subcategorize into 8 basic memes or ways of seeing things. And you know them. It's, your physical plane. It's your emotional. And right now we're doing intellectual. And there's archetypal. There's micro. Okay. There are 8 basic neurologic circuits that Timothy Leary suggested. I liked him. I liked his work. So I quote him more in terms of my reference point. And so we originally believed that the universe was quantized because of the way our brain would arbitrarily categorize one color from another. And you'll notice we have them in 8 colors, just like we do everything else. Fibonacci. That was Pythagoras. Basically, that's where the resonance part happens, where you have it's resonating with these frequency bands over those frequency bands. And we chose to see the universe as being quantized. But now, and that led us to the way information was arrayed in entanglement and decoherence. That was set for the quantum mechanical realm. Then, when the holographic universe came out, we started to talk about information as information and resolution of the information, the level at which you chunk down to observe it. And that could be emotional or physical, and that's why when we started the program, I suggested they were all the same. It's the same information, but with more detail. And that is the difference between emotional and intellectual. But they're the same, really. It's just we are chunking them into quantized bits as a way to organize our memory, and that led us to believe that the universe was quantized. I hope that's clear. It's a difficult thing to try to convey, and yet it's simple. When you talk about an automobile and you chunk it down, you know, you have your automobile and then you have the tire and then you have the lug nuts that connect the tire to the body, you know, that you start breaking it down into things and they're quantized. Well, the whole thing is it's an automobile and it does certain kinds of function. The same thing is true with information. The information in the holographic universe is assumed to be at every point in the universe, and then the way you resolve it with looking through a microscope or a telescope, the way you choose to bring that into fruition or consciousness is in one of the eight basic forms.
Talk about auto-suggestion. I notice in your book you have hypnosis sessions, rules for auto-suggestion.
Auto-suggestion is like generally for self-hypnosis, and another word could be affirmation, where I'm getting stronger and stronger with every breath I take. I'm feeling stronger and healthier. The affirmation is an auto-suggestion where you're trying to reinforce yourself. The way I basically will try to explain it to most people is to say, you are what you eat, which means if you're feeling you can't do something, don't say it, because by saying it, it goes into your ear and you reinforce that belief that you can't do something. And that's what led to the whole field of neurolinguistic programming. There were rules of the road on what you should and shouldn't do in the way the brain, different than consciousness, the way the brain heard things. It doesn't mean in sound, let's say. When you say something, if you say it this way over that way, it will have a more reinforcing effect and is stronger acting as a food, because when you say something, you're listening to yourself, and that is a form of auto-suggestion. And so it reinforces a belief. I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. I am doing this. That's a positive affirmation or auto-suggestion.
I remember this vividly as a younger person when I had a tournament tennis career of 13 years.
You played tennis?
I used to. Heavily. And I was experimenting with something during a certain portion of that time. And I turned to my mother and I said, I'm going to check something out, but I will tell you one thing. And she says, what? I said, this tournament is mine.
That's called eating their brains. I remember that.
I just said to her, I said, this is my tournament. I own it. I'm going to win it. I'm taking it. And it's mine.
You're a tough one to beat when you do that.
Well, all I can tell you is that it works. It works.
Yeah.
It works. It even alters your own vibration.
That's called beating your opponent before you even get them on the court.
Well, that's what tennis is. 9/10 of it is before you even walk in and how you are on the court.
You've already got them beaten. It's called eating their brain. I remember when I played at Forest Hills, we used to do that, and I got beaten at Forest Hills by someone that wasn't nearly as good as me, because I had a doubt when I saw those huge crowds. It made me insecure. I wasn't used to being, quote, tournament tough. Is that the right word? And because of the doubt, I fell. But in doing so, boy, did I learn a lot about myself and how we defeat ourselves. It's not the opponent that defeated us.
Yeah, it's all lying with us. Question about page 149 of your book on the non-local mind. I want to go back to this.
Okay.
You say here, nothing is really known about the physical mechanism of ESP or what is now referred to as anomalous cognition. No one knows what modulates performance. Explain again what the non-local mind is.
Well, we always used to think that our body is where we stopped in the universe, and that the universe was out there, and that our body and everything inside it was us. But with the advent of resonance and the concept of dialogue with the universe, like with Schumann's resonance, there are frequency bands on the Earth based on the geometry and the physical geometry of the Earth that lead birds to be able to have a sense of direction and location. How does that work? Well, there's a dialogue going on with electromagnetic fields around the Earth, Schumann's resonance and so on, that allow for the migration of animals. And they're in touch with that, whereas we have somehow atrophied or ignored or excluded those pieces of information as relevant to our survival. And as such, consciousness blocks out looking at those individual blades of grass on the floor, and we look at the forest rather than the trees. It's a metaphor. Everything is in metaphor. And that's the most important thing to always remember. It was Gregory Bateson, one of my professors, that once said, what is your metaphor but to serve your paradox? And that, of course, then what I had to do was have a big meadow with a bunch of ox out in it, two oxes. Your paradox.
You are doing some work in agriculture and farming now, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should explain that. That, when I left the military, I was appalled at what research I was doing. I was not ashamed, but appalled that I was developing weapons of mass destruction with mind control and things like that. That what I decided to do was leave that field and become a dirt farmer. And so I went into agriculture and became a herb farmer and found a tremendous gift of talking to the earth with my hands. You know, just putting my hands in soil was so rewarding for me that I chose to go in that direction. You know, it was Dennis Kucinich that eventually started calling me the postman, because what I do now is I network rural communities that are all over the United States. Kucinich had, when he brought me back, he did a three-hour interview with me on his radio station, and he had eight rural communities in four states that he wanted me to network with. One was in Wichita, Kansas. Another one was over there in Ohio. And what I did was try to teach them how to barter and trade. Like, this group is doing this and that group is doing that. How do we interface these two so there's a mutual admiration society where we grow with each other and we support each other's movements and or goals? And that is what's happening in America today, is there is a networking now of rural communities that are producing food. In fact, I'm a pretty strong supporter of suggesting, like Rudolf Steiner, that, you know, we are what we ate, and that the foods we're eating are so bad that what we need to do is get back to basics and build a physical body from which to launch our spiritual body. That if you can't be spiritual, if you do not have a healthy physical body, there's no way that can happen. And so it's, and because the spiritual body is the physical body. It's a manifestation of the one to the other. And the non-local part is how much outside your body you are. You are radiating electromagnetic fields. There's things called pheromone and other kinds of signals that you're sending out into the universe that other people can pick up. You know, a woman will walk in the room from the other side. You don't smell her, but somehow every eye is on her. What is that about? How does that work? What's going on there? And it has to do with the fact that our body does not stop at the layers of skin, but in fact have signals and dialogues going outside the body. And in fact, the universe outside is in fact talking to you as well, giving you your so-called intuitions and gut responses to things. And what your challenge is to do is to somehow find a way that you can bring that into consciousness and use it as an active tool rather than just a driver with no awareness. And that's going to take a lot of work. And that is the challenge of our society today, is to take personal responsibility for our own personal growth.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been speaking with Richard Allen Miller, the author of ESP Induction Through Forms of Self-Hypnosis. He's an author, a physicist, a biophysicist, an herbalist. He can be reached at richardallenmiller.com. And Richard, is there anything else you'd like to say to our audience today?
Well, okay, first off, my middle name is A-L-A-N. Rather, there's many different ways to spell Allen, so it's Richard, A-L-A-N, Miller. .com. I have other websites. We developed some foods for Navy to make us SEALs, make us supermen, one of which are what we call pharmaceutical mushrooms. I am the, the Canadian distributor for Aloha Medicinal, and we cultivate things like reishi and maitake and some of these other mushrooms that will not only get rid of diabetes and cancers, but do other things as well. What basically cordyceps does is delivers oxygen on a cellular level to the body. Your body can't get enough of that, which means that if you're eating these mushrooms, certain kinds, in certain ways, you don't get sick. And, in fact, can possibly reverse some aging access, change your age. That would be at alohamedicinals.ca for Canadian representative. And we have, with Nick Begich and several others, we're doing formulas where we're making antibiotic substitutes so that we make, for feedlots, so that we make our food sources healthy. Because if we don't do that, how can we become healthy if our food sources aren't from healthy sources? You know, my girlfriend has a chicken ranch. She has a bunch of chickens, have a couple hundred chickens, where she's doing almost 20 dozen eggs a day. And her eggs don't stick to the skillet. It's amazing. I used to eat eggs in my breakfast every morning, and then over a period of years, I stopped doing that, not knowing why. I was buying my eggs from Safeway. But when I started eating her eggs, I started eating them again because they're different than the eggs that you would get from the supermarket. Just like might be depicted in that video, Food Incorporated. When you look at how most of our foods are produced, you will stop buying your foods from Walmart or Safeway. I mean, it is appalling how bad our food supply truly is. And it's my opinion, right or wrong, it's my opinion that in the next year, it will no longer be about money. It will be about food and the quality of food that you're taking into your body. If you're not eating right, there is no way you're going to be able to become spiritual. You must begin with the physical body and then move it to the emotional and physical, intellectual, and so on. They're all the same. That's what the holographic element of our model of a universe. It will be probably shown in 50 years that the universe isn't holographic either. Actually, science is an interesting thing. You know, I don't know of any law in physics that has lasted longer than 20 years. Maxwell's right-hand rule of thumb for hitchhiking out of the galaxy, maybe, but ultimately, there has been no law that has lasted longer than 20 years in physics. And that's the truth. Does that mean that physics is growing or that it doesn't contain the answers? Well, I have dealt with Hopi. I have dealt with Tribinder and the Aborigines of Australia, and I have made a discovery. I did this when I was working with some Hopi Indian. The Navy sent me in to study these guys because they apparently could change the weather. And what they were doing was making a sand painting. And while they were making the sand painting, I was watching these clouds roll in like something on a TV show where the big alien craft is coming in behind the clouds. And this one Hopi looked at me, looked down at the sand painting, looked back at me and winked at me and ran his hand through the sand painting. And the weather went back to normal. And I stepped back and I looked at that sand painting. And you know, it looked an awful lot like a solid-state physics device. Technology has many faces, and our way of explaining it is not how it works. It's once you have it in the mind's eye, that is reality. And that's why I would say that magic is a higher form of physics, that for centuries it was reserved the ultra elite of Europe, and it was only in this last century when Aleister Crowley suggested drugs as a way to alter consciousness, which is quite valid, that, and magic, let me define magic. Magic is the art of changing consciousness at will. And so, from that point of view, magic is a higher form of physics. It's like physics with a mystery school associated to it. And I believe that is where we're going in our technologies and our concepts of reality. That's why the Hopi can do things we can't. I am so impressed with different cultures and the way they approach their reality, I'm beginning to realize we may be missing something in our attempts to explain things. And really, it's as simple as once you understand it in your own way, in your own mind, that is what makes it real.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking to, listening to, and learning from Richard Allen Miller. Richard, thank you for being with It's Rainmaking Time today. We hope that you will come back.
Yes, anytime you'd like me. Actually, we got lots more we can talk about.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard.
My pleasure.